You probably know there's a debate going on right now about whether there's a growing wave of left-wing censorship happening in progressive culture. You often hear it by the shorthand label of cancel culture, the idea being that anyone who departs from a kind of leftist orthodoxy about identity politics gets deplatformed or trashed on social media. People like Sam Harris and Bill Maher and Andrew Sullivan, among others, have been outspoken about how all of this is limiting the free flow of ideas and independent thinking. The writer Barry Weiss has emerged as one of these critics. Recently, she wrote a piece for the Deseret magazine, and we wanted to talk to her about all of this. She's going to join us on the show today, but we figured we needed to lay out some groundwork first for the conversation. So we reached out to NPR's media correspondent, David Folkenflik.
Barry Weiss was an editor for the opinion pages of the New York Times, and she was part of the charge of then editorial page editor James Bennett to expand the ideological breadth of the page's offerings, and also in some ways as a reaction to the electoral win of then President Trump. And so they wanted somebody who both spoke to and was seen to understand various flavors of the right better than the Times perhaps had done. But as she turned more from editing to writing under her own byline for the Times, she certainly seemed to generate pieces that were stickier, that were more likely to be viral and more likely to draw scrutiny and often condemnation from the left.
The opinion editor of the New York Times has just resigned amid an uproar over an op-ed by Republican Senator Tom Cotton calling for military force potentially to be used against rioters in U.S. cities.
You know, Weiss resigned last summer. It was clearly some of the aftershocks of the ouster of James Bennett as editorial page editor. He was caught up in this, in his page, publishing an op-ed by Tom Cotton, the Arkansas senator, conservative Republican, who basically was calling for the National Guard to be called out to put down protests around the country, particularly that had broken up around issues of social justice, racial inequity in law enforcement, and police brutality. Weiss basically walked away from the Times some weeks later. She said that she felt not supported in the face of not only what she felt was vicious criticism from some readers and critics, but also by some colleagues who disagreed with her views. And she felt that she was demeaned in a way that showed she was there for a kind of window dressing and that the company was unable to live up to its promises of ideological and intellectual inclusivity.
So she leaves the Times on her own, of course, but she says this is part of a larger pattern, and she's been talking about this since, that it plays out in newsrooms, it plays out on college campuses around the country right now, that you have people like academics or editors or reporters who are being silenced because they're expressing unpopular views. Is this a pattern? Is this something that we're starting to see more of, this kind of contention by Barry Weiss?
I think we're paying more attention to incidents like this than we have been in the recent past. And therefore, at times, some of the consequences may be more starkly evident to us or may be in and of themselves more severe. But I'm talking to you as a guy who started his reporting career for 6 years as someone who covered higher education in the early to mid-90s. So I remember what was called then political correctness. And the idea was that in newsrooms and in college campuses and in corporate suites, the politically correct left was smothering the ability of people to think independently. And there were times where that was true. There were episodes and outrages where that was true. But I found ultimately the claims of this to be overblown. And I think what you're seeing are certain kinds of values in conflict, where certain times people prioritize or they give precedence to specific values over other values. And the question is, each generation, each age kind of gets to do that. But in order to do that, it kind of has to be hashed out. And these clashes that occur also often occur at a time where there are efforts to change or reform or to reinvigorate or to rethink how institutions have operated in the past. And therefore, yeah, you are going to get certain kinds of cultural clashes. Weiss has made a name for herself and made a meal out of the idea that she has been wronged. And I don't think all of her work that has engendered criticism deserves her being shown the door. But I also think the Times needs to figure out a way to be a place where people of a lot of different kinds of stripes and beliefs can work and argue and present things with any luck in a constructive way.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. So Folkenflik says we've seen this before. Different name in a different time, but same concept. Only Barry Weiss argues this time it's different. The scope of social media has acted like an accelerant. She says it's a very real mob, and this is mob rule, intolerant of dissent, and has replaced forgiveness with punishment.
I'm seeing phenomenon that I thought were contained to places like the Soviet Union or other closed societies unfolding in what's ostensibly supposed to be the freest country in the history of the world. And because I live in the most liberal parts of that country, I really, really live in the blue bubble, really have for my adult life. I find it especially strange that the people who are professing to me that they're living kind of closeted lives are doing so in places that profess to live by values like diversity and inclusion and tolerance. The kind of people that I'm hearing from are people like young journalists who want to have a career in places maybe like public radio or like the New York Times and are saying to me, you know, I want to retweet. I mean, there was an example the other day of a writer I know who got in trouble for retweeting the Black intellectual Coleman Hughes. So it's down to like that level of myopic surveillance, I would say. And that surveillance is not coming, obviously, from a government. That surveillance is coming from colleagues and bosses and neighbors and other people. And then sometimes it is backed up by some of these big corporations. So that is the sort of the 10,000 foot view. And there's more examples than we could do in an hour, but I'm happy to get into any of them that you want.
Well, the examples that you've mentioned, you say that, and you can be specific or not, but you say they have this sensibility. They sound like something smuggled out of a totalitarian society, the notes that you're getting.
That is not an exaggeration. You know, listen, am I at risk here of confirmation bias? Because I have been outspoken about the danger of this illiberal culture, and therefore I am the common address that people go to, for sure. Right. But I would simply say that the kind of notes I'm getting from the places I'm getting them, from people of every class and station and race, and increasingly from all different parts of the country, have really led me to believe that we are in kind of an epidemic of self-silencing. And when I hear from a student, for example, from Harvard Law School, who is scared to write me from his school address because he's scared it would be surveilled, and then he tells me that he's closeted, this is a liberal, that he's closeted even among his friends. And again, we're talking about pretending to ascribe to every tenet of the new moral far left orthodoxy. And the fear on the part of those people is if I don't do that, I'm going to get denied a promotion, or even more basically, I won't get the job in the first place, or there will be harm to my family and to our reputation because we'll be called bigots or we'll be called racist or we'll be called any number of things that carry with them a kind of permanent moral stain. And it sounds crazy maybe to some people who haven't encountered this, but it's not crazy when you look at the kind of things that major public figures are themselves getting I hate the word canceled because it's overused, but getting canceled over. And the downstream, and I guess what I'm really interested in is like the downstream effects that that has had have been much more profound than I think most journalists realize.
When did you first start noticing it? When did you start taking note of the fact that this was taking hold in the culture?
I remember very clearly, God, I wonder if it was 2014 or 2015, when the feminist Ayaan Hirsi Ali was supposed to get an honorary degree at Brandeis. And there was an uproar at the school, and she was denied that degree. And I remember noticing that and thinking, wow, that's not good. And then I remember very, very clearly, and I think at some point historians will look back on this as not the nucleation point of all of this, but a very early sign was that famous video that happened at Yale, the instance between Nicholas Christakis, the by all accounts beloved professor at Yale, facing off on the quad against a bunch of students who were screaming and sobbing obscenities at him. And it was the kind of, it sounds like a parody, but like the root of the controversy was an email that Nicholas Christakis and his wife Erica had sent to the students in their, you know, it's residential colleges, in their residential dormitory, talking about trusting them to choose a tasteful Halloween costume. This is 2016. And I think I'd really recommend anyone listening to that to go and Google that video, because that video that I think many people at the time saw as being constrained to, you know, crazy campus politics, as Andrew Sullivan has said, well, no, we all live on campus now. And the politics that have reigned for a long time at certain American college campuses have now become the norm. And I'm not talking about the norm everywhere, obviously. I'm talking about the norm inside a particular set of institutions that I think deserve intense attention and scrutiny because they are so important to culture making, to sense making, to the world of ideas, and to the world of really establishing what is acceptable in whatever we want to call it, elite society, institutional America, that then trickles down to everyone else.
The trickles down to everyone else is the question I want to get to here in a moment, because it seems like what you're saying is this is something that you obviously notice in media or academia, but if you don't have a high profile position or really all that many social media followers, are you still being kept quiet? That is, what is the impact on most Americans in the way they live their lives? Because you're saying there's this, it's happening in these bigger institutions for sure, and that it's trickling down. I guess that's what I'm wondering. What is the impact right now on something like this on people who are outside of academia, outside of paying that much attention to the kind of media culture?
I mean, I just did a big story on schools and the way that this ideology has seeped into schools. The focus of the piece was on prep schools, but I'm now working on one about public schools. And I'll just give you a tiny example of parents, a couple that I heard from, both public school parents. He's white, she's black. They have biracial children, obviously. And they are calling me saying, this ideology has come to my child's school. It's a public school. We can't afford to send them to another school. And this ideology is teaching my child that they bear either collective victimhood or collective guilt because of their race. And we're scared because we want to speak out about it. We know that it's wrong. It would cause our own family to be divided against each other. But we are really scared because we know if we speak out about it, we might be forced out of our jobs, and very much certainly, because they're living in a liberal community and the school is liberal, will be smeared. That's the kind of thing that I'm talking about.
You say there are two illiberal cultures that are overtaking the country, and I wanted to have you break this down for us. First, you say this happens on the right as well as the left, and we'll get there to the right, but is it fair to say your focus right now anyway is what you describe as the illiberal left? Are you focused mostly on the left?
Yeah, and that's definitely one of the knocks I get And I would say it's maybe a fair criticism, is that why are you focused inordinately on this thing when the right is so bad? And I guess to that I would say, well, there's a few things. One, my home is on the left. That's where I would naturally fit. I'm, you know, feminist. I'm gay. I mean, that's always been my natural social home. And so to feel like that has been overtaken by something that is wrong has been just upsetting. And I've had a front row seat to it. That would be the second thing, is I think that I'm uniquely situated to write about this because I've been in the teeth of it myself, and because I continue to sort of be at the front lines of observing it. The last thing I would say is there are hundreds of journalists in this country who are experts on what's going on the far right, who are experts on Trump and Trumpism, and I would even say with some people, the cult of Trumpism. And sure, like I could also write the 4,000th piece explaining why that's terrible. And, you know, having been, you know, I grew up in Pittsburgh, and the synagogue where I became a bat mitzvah was the site of the deadliest attack on Jews in American history, you know, carried out by a neo-Nazi informed by these ideas. So it's not that I'm not highly attuned to their threat. It's just that there's a lot of other people. I would say basically the whole mainstream media is really, really focused on that. So those are some of the reasons that I feel obligated and also drawn to writing about this, because I do feel, at least in the legacy press, like it's really, really overlooked. And one of the reasons it's overlooked is that the very institutions that ought to be reporting on it are themselves implicated in this cultural change.
You call it describe it as this new far left orthodoxy. Explain what you mean by new exactly, and what's different about a far left orthodoxy that you're seeing play out now and a far left orthodoxy of, say, 20, 30 years ago?
I think what is different. So if you think about like the old vision of liberalism, right? That was a vision in which, just to choose one tiny example, people celebrated the fact that Justice Antonin Scalia and Ruth Bader Ginsburg were best friends who were both obsessed with opera and disagreed about just about everything when it came to jurisprudence. It's sort of hard to imagine that being held up even as an example today. And one of the things that I think is so just deadening about this ideology is that it insists that everything in life, including your friendships, including your romantic relationships, including what art you like, what movies you like, need to be seen through the lens of whatever political tribe you're a part of. So that, in that way, and I'm stealing an idea here from John McWhorter, who's written about it most articulately, it's really become a kind of new religion in which whatever political god you worship informs everything else about your life. And I just think that that is a terrible way to live. And not just that, like very boring and joyless and pleasureless and really devoid of difference, which is something that I love. Like I really, if you look at my life and who my friends are, like I like misfits and I like being around people who argue and then are happy to have a drink together. And one of the things I feel fading away right now is that ability. And then I guess I would say that in terms of just, there are like certain baseline foundational views that whether or not you vote red or you vote blue seem to be shared baselines that we took for granted, that I feel now are up for question. You know, the idea that everyone is equal, that we shouldn't judge people by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. The idea that, you know, the presumption of innocence is foundational to a liberal democracy, a revulsion to mob justice. The idea that, you know, words aren't violence. the idea that state and corporate power is something to be skeptical of, even when it's clamping down on people whose ideas you despise. I mean, all of that right now, to me at least, feels very much unsettled. And without those things, I'm very scared about where this country could be headed. And I am absolutely allergic, I think probably very much informed by my Judaism and by Jewish history, to any ideas that tell people that they're in one category or another, that they are oppressed or oppressor, that they are good or they are bad, that they're in the community of the righteous or the community of the damned. Like, my people knows very well where those ideas go. And I am alarmed by the spread of those kind of totalizing ideologies that are happening now on the far right in a very obvious way, and on the far left, I think, in a more subtle and sophisticated way.
So on the far left, you're not seeing – so let's say a far left orthodoxy of 20 years ago that had a certain opinion about the role of government and taxes and reproductive rights and equal rights and social justice – that's not necessarily different today. It's just the approach or the tolerance of people who don't agree with that. That's what maybe is different.
I think it's actually not about any of those things. I don't think this is about gay marriage or abortion rights, both of which I support. I don't think this is about taxes. I don't think this is about pick your issue, environmentalism, like carbon tax. It's not about any of that. It's about very fundamentally, do we believe that America is a good country with all of its flaws, whose ideas are exceptional in human history, and whose ideas deserve the fullest defense and protection? Again, even as we realize that we're always, as Lincoln put it, trying to perfect our union, that it's never going to be perfect? Or do we believe that America is not just born in original sin, but that it is perpetuating, on balance, more evil than good, and that the ideas that the founders came up with are unsalvageable because of their moral hypocrisy, rather than exceptional despite that moral hypocrisy? I think that is what's at stake here. It's not about any policy. It's about a fundamental view of America, of liberalism, and frankly, of the American ideals. That's what I think is at stake here.
Barry Weiss was an opinion editor and a writer for the New York Times from 2017 to 2020. Her article for the March issue of the Deseret magazine is called The Self-Silencing Majority. We'll take a break, come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
I am Eric Lopez, and I love supporting and sustaining KUER. It started out because I just wanted to support Radio West, but realized like there's other things that go on, right? Like the Trump impeachment trials and the nonstop coverage of that, and be able to hear the commentary around that. You guys pick up on important things and know when something historical is happening, and that's important to me.
Support KUER during our spring fund drive. Go to KUER.org/donate.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us the writer Barry Weiss. Weiss made headlines last summer when she resigned from the New York Times. She said the paper and other institutions were giving in to what she describes as this new illiberal orthodoxy. When writers and editors demur from this party line, she says, they're shamed and silenced. We should also point out she's also critical of the same kinds of intolerance of new ideas on the right. Back now to our conversation. One of the things you argue in your piece is that the principal mode in this way of thinking, this kind of illiberal ideology, is not building or renewing or reforming, but as you put it, tearing down. And I wanted to ask you about some of the tools that you reference. Mm. You say these days persuasion has been replaced with public shaming, and that forgiveness has been replaced with punishment. Mm-hmm. Take those two in particular. What are you seeing there? This idea of shaming and an unwillingness to forgive people for things they may have said or done in the past, or even for things they're saying in the present.
God, there are so many examples on this. I just think that one of the greatest moral inventions is the idea of forgiveness and of grace and of second chances and of mercy. And I feel like those ideas have been really lost in this moment. And, you know, I think about, like, I don't know if you guys remember, the Times did this story on this 16-year-old girl, maybe she was 15, named Mimi Groves, who sang along in a 3 or maybe 5 second TikTok video. And the song she was singing along to had the N-word in it. And one of her classmates saw the video and recorded it and hung on to it. And then he deployed it after she was offered, I believe it was a scholarship to the University of Tennessee, and that was rescinded. And I found that so disturbing, the idea that a young person would be ruined for a 5 second TikTok video. You know, I think of the example of, there was a guy, maybe you guys remember this, of Emmanuel Cafferty. He's a Hispanic worker at the San Diego utility company. And he was driving by a rally and he had his hand hanging out the window. And it looked to some people like he was making the okay sign, which now you can't make because some people have repurposed it in a way as a white supremacist hand gesture. And someone took a picture. And within several hours, he was fired. And no amount of apologizing, no amount of saying, "That's, what are you talking about? Like, that's not what I was doing. I'm not a white supremacist. I don't even know what you're saying." None of that was enough. I think about, I mean, I could really go on with dozens of examples here. What's going on is people being sort of condemned by a virtual firing squad often. And then there's no mechanism for a second chance. There's no mechanism for rehabilitation. And I find it strange that a lot of the people that are defending this kind of thing as some kind of, I don't know, writing of a historical wrong, are this very same people who argue, I think rightly, for mercy and for criminal justice reform on the part of people who have committed actually heinous crimes. So that's what I'm talking about when I talk about shaming.
I wonder if you think that when people are in extremis, when, like, under the conditions of a pandemic or under the leadership of a polarizing national leader like Donald Trump, if under those conditions people just were not thinking very rationally, that we have to get beyond that moment of crisis before we can start to think again rationally and respond rationally. Do you think in some way that may be contributing to what you're saying, that kind of intolerance?
Without a question. I mean, I think that a lot of these this was growing. These ideas have been the ideas that this movement is based on have been around since the 60s. So it's not that they weren't in the culture, but I think that the figure of Donald Trump, which genuinely alarmed many people for completely reasonable reasons, I mean, I was one of them. I think it supercharged this polarization. And I also think that COVID-19 and the lockdown and interacting with other human beings only as two-dimensional avatars, including your own colleagues and your own family members, has absolutely been a major, major catalyzing force. And the question is, like, can that be undone? And if it can, how can it be undone? Because we can't unplug the internet, right? Yeah. And the question is, like, how do we stay human in a world in which we have our real selves and then we have our online selves? And often I find, I don't know if you guys find this, that, like, there's such a gap between how people are in real life and how they are on the internet. Yep. And yet those two things often seem to be collapsing, right? Because you can say until you're blue in the face that Twitter isn't real life. But when Twitter manages to get you fired from your job, it really kind of does seem like real life to a lot of people.
Yeah. how we sort of fix all of this is something I'm really interested in and I want to get to in a second. I want to ask you something else, though. Do you think, Barry, can you sympathize with or empathize with this sense of impatience that also seems to be driving some of this intolerance, that for certain people, they want to take advantage of this moment? I mean, you know, this is in some cases groups of people who don't have often the upper hand in a situation. So right now they do, and they want to take advantage. And so they don't want to give way to compromise, at least not yet. Mm-hmm. Are you seeing any of that in here?
Yeah, but I guess I would ask those people, what is it that they want? What is it that they want? Because I see a lot, you know, going back to the question you asked before about the kind of teardown being the main mode here, I see a lot of people that see that they have, you're right, like an opening and demanding certain things, but the demands never seem to be about building things. They often seem to be about punishing other people. So, yeah, I mean.
But wait, but what is that? Where is that coming from? And what is that? Like, if you can trace it, I'm not sure if you do or have. I mean, one thing you do talk about is classical liberal principles. So this inability to compromise, this inclination to want to tear down, not build up, where is that coming from? Have you been able to trace it?
God, that is a deep psychological question. I think power is very seductive. I mean, certainly that's true. I also think that hate can really bind people toward each other. Hatred of other people is a very powerful adhesive, maybe would be the right word, in groups. You know, if you have an enemy, that can be very powerful as a binding agent. And yeah, I just think that hate can, it sounds strange, but hate can really connect people. And communities, I think, can become quite strong around hatred of people that you don't like. And that can feel really good to give into it. I also think in the case of media that hatred, unfortunately, is a very, very lucrative business model. And the deeper question about what is drawing people to this, I think, has to do with the fact that we're living through, I think, what will be remembered as the final collapse of a particular social order and the beginning of a new realignment. And lots of people like Robert Putnam and others have written about this, but just the total loss of religion, the decline of so many organizations that used to bind people together, the fact that you go to a lot of American towns. I mean, I'm from Pittsburgh. You drive 1 hour outside of Pittsburgh and they're like ghosts. In these towns, they're totally emptied out. You know, the rise of the Amazons of the world, debt, you know, like, I mean, we could go on and on and on. Like, it actually shouldn't be a surprise to us that people are being drawn toward more extremist political movements, and that given the loss, I would say, of church, synagogue, mosque, whatever you want to call it, the loss of faith, I think that has only made people cling to these ideologies maybe more so than they would in another moment with similar social and economic crises.
What could replace religion? It seems like what you're saying is that
nothing.
Okay, that's what I wanted to ask, because this is something you mentioned. I mean, one of the things you talk about in terms of the liberal culture that you were born into, not liberal in the political way, but liberal in the classical way, you say that both on the right and the left, there was this shared liberal, in that sense, consensus. And one of the things was this, that everyone is created in the image of God. That's what you say.
Yeah.
And that the belief that everyone is equal because of that.
Yes.
So you also write about that one of the things that is really changing in American life is, as you just said, this loss of religion.
Yeah.
So talk a little bit more about that. What happens when you have an increasingly secular society?
Really, I love this question. In an age in which, you know, according to many, God is dead, how do we is there a way to replace that anchoring force?
Yeah.
And yeah. someone like, you know, Balaji Srinivasan and the various transhumanist people will say, you know, it's living forever. That's what it is. And others will say, you know, it's the blockchain and it's Bitcoin and it's decentralization. And there's all of these interesting conversations that go on kind of among the, whatever we want to call them, transhumanist futurist community. I think there are ways to get to the view that everyone is created equally and is entitled to equality under the law without believing in God with a capital G. But I'm not sure, let's just say, I am not at all convinced that those things that I just mentioned and rattled off to you can be the kind of anchor that religion or faith, or let's call it just like also community, which I think is very, very important. It's not just about belief. It's about obligation to other people, duty to a community. Can you get to those things without God? I think you can, but I don't think there's any like shortcut, I guess is what I would say. I just really don't think that there's like a way that you can minimum viable product that thing. That thing is irreplaceable.
One thing that's interesting is, and this is something you see reflected often on the right, at least in that conversation about how is it that somebody could support Donald Trump and still be a good, legitimate Christian? We're hearing this argument forever. And the often the question is this image of God, what is so – like Christians talk about the God of the New Testament and the God of the Old Testament. The God of the New Testament is – compassionate and loving. The God of the Old Testament is more wrathful, more punitive. And for some reason, a lot of Christians these days are more drawn into the God of the Old Testament. Like, is it about the image of God and your concept of God that may be part of this conversation? Like, why it is that people are inclined to demonize or punish?
What I would say is, it's funny to me to have it phrased that way because, you know, I don't have an Old and a New Testament.
Right. You only have the old one.
I only got the one. And yeah. I don't think that, you know, at least in my reading of that, it leads to wrath or rage or pouring out your fire on your enemies. Although obviously that's in the text, but like all religion, you know, it really just depends on what you want to emphasize. There are people for whom, you know, one line in Leviticus about homosexuality seems to inform their entire view of religion. And, you know, there are other people who overlook that. So, you know, it's really just about emphasis. I also think that it's, without sounding like too high-minded, the veneer of civilization is extremely thin. Like the ability, let's just even take my own life, right? Like my ability to walk down the street wearing a tank top, holding the hand of my fiance who's a woman, like, and not get like beaten in the street, like that's unbelievable. You know, like I don't take that for granted. And a lot of people worked very, very, very hard to make that possible for me, at least in the part of LA where I live. Obviously not true everywhere in the country, but in general true, much different than going to a lot of countries in the world. And so as someone who, like, you know, there are places where I could go where that is simply not true, or even take, you know, I wear a Jewish star around my neck. Are you kidding? Like there's no way in hell that I could go to a lot of places in the world brandishing that. And so I am just very aware of how quickly those things can fall away. And if, you know, you're talking about the Old Testament, for me, it's about Jewish history. Like being a student of Jewish history has made one thing extremely clear to me, which is that when those, I don't know, civilizing forces, civilizing institutions are rotted out or decayed or attacked or fall away, it is very, very dangerous, not just for the Jews, but ultimately for everyone. And maybe that's the thing that's kind of given me a particular nose for this, or maybe made me especially sensitive to it.
I think it's important to say that your understanding of why a lot of young people seem to be drawn to this kind of illiberal thinking is that you don't think it's because of a lack of intellect, you say in your piece.
No.
And you don't think they're snowflakes. You say that they are responding to this because they want to feel some kind of connection and they want to have this sense of meaning in a very confusing time. So there is an essential kind of empathy that you feel for why people are drawn to this. I guess the question is, how do you fix that? How do you give a connection mm-hmm. that doesn't require shaming someone or being unwilling to forgive someone?
It's impossible to overstate how deep the crisis of loneliness and isolation is in our culture. And then, I mean, that was true before the lockdown that began a year ago. And now it's like, it's kind of impossible to even wrap your arms around it. And so if you're a young person and most of your life is taking place online, and you see this tribe that seems to have a lot of passion and a lot of meaning and maybe even some justifiable enemies, like, of course, like, I can imagine myself being drawn to that.
Yeah.
And as for how do we overcome it, I really think that the answer is not about more politics. I think the answer is about building other institutions and communities that are just perpendicular to this. Like right now we're seeing a kind of cottage industry, maybe some would say I'm part of it, of like anti-cancel culture, anti-woke. But like if your identity or your reason for being is based on defensiveness and kind of just pushback, it's just reactionary. And ultimately it's just not that deep or meaningful or pleasurable. And so I think a lot of like where I want my energy to be going and where I encourage other people is like, how do we build a new world that would feel so much better to live in than the one that we're currently in?
Yeah. What are you seeing in the criticism of your deciding to resign from the New York Times, from the way you've been outspoken since? Moira Donegan of the Guardian, for example, mentioned that what you've done is frame a lot of rude online reaction to your opinion and your decision to leave as a First Amendment issue. She says that you've confused this personal sense of discomfort that you have with it being a violation of your civic right to free speech. Mm. I mean, how like, I guess she's saying you can't take the heat or something.
Of
so
course.
How are you responding to what you're hearing? That and generally speaking.
I think what my critics would say about me is that I'm guilty of the very thing that I accuse others of, that I myself am a snowflake or something like that. It's really interesting, right? So I would ask someone like Moira Donegan, who seems highly sensitized to even the smallest microaggressions against communities or people that she perceives as being weak or, you know, having victim status, that, you know, what would she say if, you know, a Black employee at the New York Times or an Asian employee at the New York Times or queer employee at the New York Times said to her, you know, in Slack channels with thousands of people, including the publisher of the paper, people are putting axe and guillotine emojis next to my name, or people are calling me a Nazi in the workplace, or people are saying, why are you writing about the Jews again? Like, I do think that there's somewhat of a double standard here. When it comes to complaints that come from a group that for whatever reason are not perceived as having the same vulnerability. So I would simply say that. As for the claim that, you know, First Amendment, not First Amendment, look, I understand full well that, you know, my First Amendment rights, you know, don't apply inside a private organization and they can fire me at will, of course, obviously. All I would say to that is, you know, if a paper is claiming to be the paper of record and to pursue the news without fear or favor and pursue all of the news that's fit to print, you know, I think the question for readers is the New York Times doing that anymore when it has pushed out not just, you know, it is pushed out or sort of encouraged out or made an environment so hostile that it was pretty hard to work there out. So many people. So I guess that's what I would say.
Alex Shepard in The New Republic said that that you are mischaracterizing what was going on, that there's not a civil war happening at the Times or other places, that these are editorial conversations. They're kind of benign. You're blowing out of proportion.
Right. Yeah, I mean, those are people with a real stake in that war themselves. So I wouldn't trust their reporting on it. I mean, what I would say is, I think that there was a Twitter thread that I put out before I left that kind of went viral about the generational gap. I thought it was extremely benign, but apparently other people didn't. I think it holds up unbelievably well, and that it's not really about just the New York Times. I mean, that's really what I would say. Most importantly, this is about a ideological, I mean, what the critic Wesley Yang has called an ideological succession. This is about, and again, it doesn't always break down along generational lines, but it often does. You know, in the case of the news business, is the job of the New York Times to strive for objectivity, even as we all, of course, know that we're subjective? Is the job to hold up a mirror to the country, even when what you see in that mirror can be ugly? Or is our job to push a particular political line and to strive for, as Wesley Morris has put it, something like moral clarity? That is the great divide. That is extremely real. And that's not just at the New York Times. It's in so many institutions right now. That's what I would say.
Maura Donegan does make a point I wonder if you agree with, that people need to stop giving clicks and hours of time to this outrage. She writes that if we want these people to be less powerful, then we have to stop giving them what they want, which is our attention. You probably agree with that, don't you?
I mean, honestly, one of the reasons I left the paper beyond my personal situation was like I felt bad to be part of a business whose strategy so obviously, increasingly and understandably, is about stoking polarization. And the reasons for that are not like some malevolent plot. You know, it goes back to the advent of the internet and the transferring of money from, you know, it used to be that you had to answer to advertisers. Now you have to answer to your subscribers. And guess what? 95% of New York Times subscribers are liberals and Democrats. So of course they want the heroin hit. Of course. You could say the same exact thing about people that watch Fox News and Tucker every night.
You say the only place we can start is an appeal to courage and duty. Say something about that finally, if you would.
I mean, more and more, I just feel drawn to those things. And that, you know, for me, like when you think about what is considered courageous right now, right? Like some people say to me, leaving the New York Times, so courageous. And I'm like, I guess, but not really. Not if you think about, you know, one of my great heroes is the Soviet dissident Natan Sharansky, who now lives in Jerusalem, but who spent 10 years in the Gulag, many of those in an isolation cell, in a punishing cell, where he would play chess games in his head for the sin of wanting to leave the Soviet Union and join his wife in the state of Israel. That is courage, right? Like standing up leaving your job, standing up for your values in your kid's school. Yeah. Does that require like some kind of spine? Absolutely. But I think having a bit of historical perspective, whether that's in, you know, thinking about your own lineage, because we all come from somewhere, or honestly thinking about American history and what people in this country sacrificed for the greater good. Like, I think we need a bit of a return to that kind of thinking and to those virtues in this moment.
Very wise. Thank you so much.
Thank you, guys.
Barry Weiss. Her latest book is How to Fight Antisemitism. You can find her article in the latest issue of the Deseret magazine. It's called The Self-Silencing Majority. We'll put a link to it on our website. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, we'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter at Radio West. Our intern is Aaron Camargo, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Christy Miners is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.